Hi, I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Eddie Bitton, OD, Associate Professor and Director of Externships and Director of the Dry Eye Clinic at the School of Optometry at the University of Montreal, Canada. Where did you grow up?
So I basically, most of my life, I've been growing up in Montreal. And so this is where I went to elementary school and high school and university. So most of my upbringing has been here in Montreal. And so that explains a bit to my love for the city. I love the city. I don't like it in January. I don't like it in the middle of the winter, but I think it's a very vibrant city with a lot of things to add. It's very multicultural and I really like the vibe, and I'm very proud to show it off.
What did your parents do?
My dad's an engineer. He's an architect. And my mom did quite a few things over the years. Probably most of it is just, you know, having her family. I am one of six children. So that was a pretty big responsibility for her. But she's been a teacher and she was a part-time nurse and she was, she just kept reinventing herself over the years. So I admire that.
I was going to ask you a question about what it was like to attend a university and work at a university that speaks French, but I'm assuming that you grew up being bilingual, having grown up in Montreal. So
yeah, well, my native language is French, but at the time, most of my schooling has been in English. Actually, pretty much all of my schooling has been in English since elementary school. But elementary and high school, you have to learn French anyway, so it's pretty bilingual type of program. And then by the time you get to university, obviously, you know, you pick your thing. I went to McGill University here in Montreal, and then after that, I ended up at the University of Waterloo to do my optometry school.
What did you do your undergrad in?
In biology and human genetics. Yeah, which was very interesting for me to just lots of ethical questions, which I had to ponder very early on in my life, that seemed to be very sci-fi-ish, you know, very science fiction. The whole genetic concept seemed to be very far away, and yet that's where we're at now. You know, we've mapped the DNA genome, and we understand so much more, and yet there's so much more to understand still. But it was interesting, the conversations I had in the early 80s with my professors about, you know, genetic mutations and genetic manipulation and what the ethics of it all, you know, is kind of coming back, because now it is a realistic thing to do. So it had positives, it had negatives, but it was a lot of ethical consideration way back then.
So why contact lenses and why dry eye?
Well, my path has not been an easy one. Nobody plans out to know exactly what they end up turning out to be. I did optometry practice for several years, joined the university here, joined on faculty. I decided to do my master's, and my clinical master's was in dry eye, was basically in the tear film. And that's really made me realize how many people really suffer from dry eye or dry eye related problems, whether it's related to contact lenses or just straight out dry eye, how much it comes with age. I think I underscored it like everybody else and just figured it was like, yeah, you know, get a couple teardrops, you're fine, you know, but really it just grew to something was a much bigger problem than we anticipate. And so as I sort of moved on and read on and went to conferences and, you know, discuss new developments in the area, I just became very passionate about it. And that's probably one word that describes me, is I like to be passionate about what I do, or else I'm not sure how long I would have lasted in the academic setting. You know, so that's what drives me. And I just like to help people, you know, so those two things kind of like went in line. There's a huge need for dry eye. People are still underscoring it. Many health professionals are underscoring it, and a lot of people are still really suffering. And I think that our environment has changed, that our visual needs are different now with the use of digital devices, that we need better vision. You know, it's not because you're 50, 55 that you're retiring anytime soon. You know, it's more like there's just so many things that have changed that require us very, very good vision. And people are living longer, active lives, whether they retire or not, whatever their hobbies are, they will probably cross paths with some sort of digital device. And we just blink less because we're concentrating. And so dry eye related to digital devices is just a huge problem. And, you know, related to medication, just age, postmenopausal women, you know, just all this stuff. It's just unbelievable. So, you know, we started a dry eye clinic in 2012 at the University of Montreal. And we were really one of the first ones that incorporated a dry eye clinic within our clinical services. And that kind of like started a bit of a trend, you know, like since then it's been dry eye clinic this, dry eye clinic that, which I think is fantastic because the more awareness there is, people are going to try to push that dry eye thing forward. So, you know, that's kind of why I got into dry eye. So I love it. I don't get bored of it. It kind of, you know, sort of drives my passion and, helping people is like I said, it kind of like, you know, helps me do that as well. So
why academia instead of a private practice or industry? I know you mentioned just now that you were in practice.
Yeah, I was in practice for many years, actually, probably over like about 10 years or so, and started to slow that down as I got an opportunity in academics. And like everyone else, we don't, you know, just fully get a professor role. You typically come in as a supervisor in the clinic one day a week and, you know, somebody talks to you about a project or about a course and then you get in, oh, sure, I'll do that course, you know, or I'll do a portion of that course. You sort of like, you know, eventually get sucked into this academic black hole, you know. But no, I look back and it's like I don't regret being in academics. I actually thank the person that kind of showed me the way into here. On any given day, I could be as frustrated as anybody else. But it's offered me opportunities that I wouldn't have otherwise had in clinical practice. I still enjoy clinical practice. I still do it from time to time here and there to keep my skills up, obviously. But it's offered me an unbelievable opportunity to meet colleagues from around the world. And also to be able to go to conferences, share my knowledge or get knowledge at more of a teaching sort of, you know, role. I go to many meetings that actually just talk about education and the challenges of our particular topics. And I've met just wonderful people from all the optometry schools, at least in North America, about that. And that, and I have found that that's fulfilled me a lot. It drives me. It kind of recharges my batteries. Every time I come back from a meeting, it's like, yes, you know, I have this and this that I can do tomorrow. So it's kept me going. You know, it's like the little energizer bunny that's like I just needed a fill because it's therapeutic to go to a meeting and meet friends and colleagues that are experiencing the same challenges as you are. And so I've often used that word therapeutic because we all just bitch at the same you know, meeting, but what we're really doing is sharing. And it's a great venue to vent some frustrations and that it's also good to know that you're not the only one living them. So it's nice to see other people are having the same challenges and that, you know, you try to find a collective way of moving forward and trying to address those challenges. So that has been very positive in my life.
How has the representation of women in optometry changed?
That's an interesting question. So there is a journal called Women in Optometry. They do annually sort of like a census of how many women and men in the entering class for the last few years. In Montreal, it's actually been kind of interesting because I actually did this little exercise several years ago. Montreal has had most women in the program since almost the 70s. We've been almost way over 50% women since the 70s. And now I think we've been in the 80s, 80% women. Healthcare is a women kind of profession. And I think people get into healthcare because of the marks and the school, the way it's designed, women do better than men in terms of entering into such a program. Once they're in the program, of course, they equally do very well. And it's not to say men don't do well in these professions. Of course they do, but it's the way to get into the program that is so based on marks that the high school is meant, is designed to be more attractive for, not attractive, that's not the word I want to say. It's just designed so that women can actually perform better than men.
It facilitates the academic performance of women, you think?
Yeah, because I think it's a lot of memorization, a lot of like concentration, and it's not necessarily all hands-on. Like typically guys do very well at hands-on type concepts. But whatever the case is, it's just like I think that the women get in because of the marks. And so we've been really lucky that way, in that sense that we have we've had way more than 50% of women for many years, many, many years. So I think the face of the profession is changing and has changed over the last several decades, and is not likely to change anytime soon. I think that that's going to continue to change, in all of the healthcare, not just optometry, dentistry, pharmacy, medicine. These were very male dominated, and now they are very women dominated. So.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
Most people know I'm from Montreal. Most people know I speak French. I think most people don't know where I was born. I was born in Casablanca, Morocco.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes I give them hints and I tell them, I say, look, I was born where, do you know where, Bogey's from? Little things like that. But most people don't know I was born in Casablanca, Morocco. But I left when I was 5 years old, so most of my upbringing has really been here in Montreal. My parents, they were both born in Casablanca. Things became a bit unstable, and so they wanted opportunities for them and security, and so they moved, and my dad was able to be transferred with his company, and so we came to Montreal, and they were very open to immigrants at the time, as they always are. And the fact that Montreal spoke French was facilitated for both my parents, because obviously in Morocco you either speak French, that's the working language, or Arabic, I guess. But my parents both spoke French, and so it was an easier transition for them to come to Montreal.
That is so marvelous.
I've often asked them, they moved to Montreal when they were about 35 years old. And when I was about 35 years old and I had my kids, and I told them, I said, I'm trying to relate to how you were when you moved, or the decision to uproot your family literally to the other side of the world. And I said, I don't know if I would do that, like now, like if I have to leave everything I've known and where I grew up with my kids and kind of uproot, but I wasn't put in their situation. I don't know what they went through. And so, but it was a hard decision, and I had good conversations with them to, why did they do that? What regret did they have? Who did they leave behind? And including their comforts. They had certain comforts back home that obviously they didn't have here. I mean, just the simple weather. They never saw snow.
Yeah, that's a huge shock right there.
Yeah, and it's like they didn't understand why in the middle of December you couldn't buy oranges. It's just, it's back in the early 60s or 70s when we moved here. They just didn't come from California all the way from here. I mean, now you just put them on a plane and you have whatever you want. But they just didn't understand why you didn't have all the fruits and vegetables all year long, because that's what they were used to, right? So it was quite a bit of adaptation on their part. But it made me realize how much they really did sacrifice later on in life. I wouldn't have had the opportunities, I think, back there that I've had in a Canadian and North American type environment. From anything from an educational standpoint to all the rights for women and the liberties that I had and I enjoyed as a woman. So, I don't think I would have had that aspiration. So it, I eventually I thank them for making the move, or else I wouldn't be here talking to you. So there you go.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. The dedicated dry eye clinic at the University of Montreal was the first amongst North American optometry schools. How did the clinic come to be?
Well, after my master's on dry eye, on the tear film and the need for dry eye, we certainly saw a lot of cases of dry eye in the clinic. But we saw some in the dry eye clinic, and then some was treated in the ocular health clinic, and that's typically where dry eye is assessed in all of the optometry school type clinics. It's just that we kept seeing in the literature and, more things coming out on dry eye. And this was a couple of years after the DEWS report, so the dry eye workshop that occurred in 2007 really showed us like a little bit more of a systematic approach to dry eye. And we weren't really doing that. Everybody was kind of like doing a little bit here and a little bit that. And we all thought we were doing the right thing. And I'm sure that at some point we were. But it needed to be more systematic. And we kind of just toyed around with the idea for quite a while until it became, it came to fruition that we said, look, we have a contact lens clinic, we have a binocular vision clinic, we have a low vision clinic, we have all these clinics that really target a particular issue. Why don't we have a dedicated dry eye clinic? And that's kind of like how it grew. But then the next question was, well, what are we going to do during this appointment? And the DEWS report was really the foundation for us to build on. Well, this is what the international community is knowledge, this is what it's at right now. And so we're going to build from there. So everything is very, very evidence-based. And since the dry clinic opened up, I just could not believe the outpouring of, sort of positive feedback I've had. First of all, patients are thrilled because they're saying, oh my God, somebody's really taking me seriously. A lot of them have doctor hopped for many years, tried many things. And so just the systematic approach to their appointment was something that was, wow, kind of like new for them, really novel. They felt that they were, oh, I must be in good hands because this is the first person that's actually talking to me about dry eye only and not trying to talk about dry eye within a whole bunch of other things of the exam. So they felt very secure and very kind of like taken care of in that environment. And over the years, we started with half a day a week. And eventually we saw that we had a 3 month backup of appointments. And so we said, okay, time to increase it. So we went to 1 day a week and then 1.5 day a week. And now we're at 2 days a week. And there's probably room for more. So we are, it's really gotten a lot of attention of our colleagues. It is strictly a referral clinic because we did not want to take away anything from our colleagues. Now, Montreal is a very big city, and so there's many optometrists and ophthalmologists in the area. We wanted to make them comfortable to refer to us just for that, and that we would refer them back. So, having a referral process allows us to maybe establish that professional collaboration. And so when they refer to us, then we send them back a report and refer them back their patient. And so we're not here to take patients away for other reasons. We're just strictly doing that. And it's worked really well. And ophthalmologists are very pleased. Optometrists are pretty pleased. Patients are very pleased. And the industry is pleased as well. So, seeing that dry eye is a little bit more at the forefront. They're trying to collaborate with us as well. They're very happy that dry eye is really taken in a more systematic way. And so we have really become a bit more of the beacon for dry eye in our area, and it's like, that's fantastic, So I certainly get a lot of feedback from my colleagues in industry saying, hey, what are you doing at the university? We want to start a dry eye clinic in our office. What have you done? What are some of your growing pains? And, we'll share that information gladly, but we just want people to have an evidence-based, systematic approach to dry eye and not everybody kind of doing their own thing. Now with the DEWS 2 report that came out, that's even stronger, so that continues our ability to move forward with an evidence-based approach. And I was very honored to be asked to be part of the DEWS 2 effort. And so I'm on one of their committees, and I am myself and someone else are the Canadian ambassadors for the TFOS DEWS 2. So that's a big honor for me, and that's telling me that somewhere along the way, I'm kind of doing the right thing, and people are seeing outside of my own academic walls, and that's great.
Why is it important for ODs to have a basic strategy for a patient's dry eye workup?
I think, well, again, I think that we need to re-examine a lot of the recommendations we do for dry eye. Or let me back up. Dry eye is pretty complicated, and I think that still, to a lot of health professionals, we have underscored dry eye for many years because we don't understand it. We are slowly, and I mean slowly, unraveling the many facets of dry eye. It is a disease. It affects many tissues. And so I think that complexity has made it difficult to be very simplistic in our approach. That being said, I think that the multi approach that we have for management, whether it's lid hygiene, hot compresses, artificial drops, advanced technologies, et cetera, takes time to sort of trickle down to the OD. You need to show that this works. You need to show the evidence. You need to show that, how to educate the patient. So I'd like to pick two examples where this is really pertinent in my view. One is the warm compress. Many people have said, yeah, use a warm compress, it'll help your dry eye. The most recommended compress that's out there is probably just a warm face cloth. Now, I agree that everyone has a face cloth at home, so that's very easy to get. But there are many, many times that we've shown now that it is inefficient at providing the heat that is really necessary to help you. And so that message and that proof that there are better eye masks out there that do the job has to take time to trickle down through the evidence, through the science, get to conferences, to get the word out, to get to the optometrist, so that the optometrist and other healthcare professionals, such as pharmacists, ophthalmologists, and whatnot, understand this information and then transfer it to the patient. It's unfortunate that it has to take that long, but it does. So that's one thing. The second thing, oh, actually, there are many, but that just to choose one, is one to clean your eyelashes or your eye, your basically lid hygiene with baby shampoo. I mean, everyone says just use baby shampoo, but baby shampoo was never designed for the eyes. Baby shampoo was designed for your hair. And if it got into your eyes, it was gentle enough, but that never made it into an eyelid hygiene product. And yet it's ubiquitously sort of, sure, use baby shampoo. It doesn't do the job. In a recent article that came out in January, actually shows that it's potentially harmful to the tear film. So we really should not be advocating that. But again, we just kind of say it without questioning. Well, now we have to be more evidence-based. Why do we do these things? We really should question ourselves. Why are we recommending this? Do I have data to back this up? And has this data changed over the last few years? And it's my job as a clinician to be at the forefront of that change. I need to educate myself to make sure I know the latest thing that I'm recommending to my patients.
Not many ODs write about parasites. How did you get interested in Demodex mites?
Well, here's an interesting one. So I told you I said I love to go to conferences and it really sort of charges my battery. And this is exactly an example. I went to a conference. I was at the American Academy of Optometry, attended a conference that talked about dry eye and about, the tear film and blah, blah, blah. And they showed about anterior blepharitis, which is an inflammation of the eyelid, and we can have many causes of it. Usually it's bacterial, but sometimes it's not. And they threw up a whole bunch of pictures about this Demodex. And I sat there and going, oh, wow, I don't think I've ever seen this. And yet when they showed pictures of lids, I've said, but I've seen this, but I haven't seen the parasite. Now, of course, we don't typically have microscopes in our practices. And so these are microscopic, and obviously we don't tend to pull out an eyelash, look at it under a microscope. It is not something that we typically do. But I'm in academics. I have access to a microscope. And so But I think that the one line of that conference that made the difference for me was saying that this typically, you know, increases with age. And if you have patients over 70, that the likelihood of having Demodex as a blepharitis or as a cause is almost nearing 100%. And that kind of threw me aback because I said, I've got plenty of patients over 70, and I certainly have seen many, many patients over 70. So I may have missed this for a long time. And I felt very guilty as a practitioner, but I was also very curious. So after the conference that Monday morning, I started taking a look very closely or more closely at the lids. And sure enough, I got myself a microscope and started pulling some eyelashes. And to my absolute astonishment, I could not believe how many people have Demodex. And so it just kind of threw me onto this path of like, wow, this is super interesting because I've missed this. I'm sure I'm not the only one that's missed this. And so how do you start gathering data? What is Demodex? Where does it come from? How does it occur? What does it look like clinically? How could I guide my students, my colleagues, to maybe be, to not miss it like I did for years? How do I make them comfortable at realizing that this is the clinical portrait, but this is what you should do? And then, the Demodex story kind of like started to be a buzz in a lot of the conferences. So you started to learn about tea tree oil as a potential management option. I didn't know a thing about tea tree oil. So you got to start reading, you know, so you educate yourself. And I just moved on and moved on. I have many students doing a lot of different projects now on Demodex. And I don't think it's gross. I think it's kind of cool. I like to see little bugs under the microscope move. I think it certainly like makes the patient be 100% compliant when they see the little bugs. Under the microscope. But some patients you may not want to show them. Some don't want to see it. But I think it's a great, you know, again, it's just serendipity. I was at a conference. It just kind of piqued my interest and I went from there.
Happen to be at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, well, sometimes you just got to be in tune. But, you know, this is what I tell people at a conference. If you go to a conference and you learn something new, but you don't apply it, you've never moved forward. And so when I give a conference, that's what I want to really send as a message. You can listen to me, you cannot listen to me, but if you find something interesting, great. If you find something you could apply, great, but you need to apply it Monday morning because you need to change something in your practice. If not, you have not evolved. And I'm a very strong believer of that, that it's like the profession will never evolve if we don't keep moving forward, 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 forward all the time.
What's something you would change about optometry as it stands now?
This is a sort of overarching thing. I think optometry has come a long way within the public's eye. I think I would love to see it being considered at a how do I want to say this? I think politically, optometry has come a long way, but I don't think that it's always been taken very seriously as another health profession. I think we've moved in that direction. I don't think we've hit the peak of our recognition as a profession and as a primary eye care professional. In some parts of the world, yes, that certainly has moved up the ranks. But on a world stage, I don't think that we've yet met that mark. So I think that there's still work to do. I think the individual patient sees our value. I think as you move up sort of the health care sort of scale, I think we still have work to do there. So we need to be better represented at some of the higher level of health care.
What's your guilty pleasure food?
I'm not much of a sweet tooth person, but I do love French tarts. I really do. And my favorite one is a strawberry French tart. That's my guilty pleasure.
Now, do you bake them yourself, or is there a
Oh
specific,
God,
or
no.
is there a place that you go to Montreal to get them?
Yeah, no, I will be very picky. So you need to go to a good French bakery. Yes. No, I cannot bake. I love to cook. I love to bake, but there's no way I'm going to go there. That's like a cheesecake. That's like a New York cheesecake. That's my second guilty pleasure. Definitely cheesecake. But there's no way I'm gonna like, I think if I see all the ingredients that actually go in it, I would say, no, this is too many calories. So no, my guilty pleasure is to go to a really nice French pâtisserie and get a really nice strawberry French tart. Yeah.
Is there a particular one, a favorite one that you have locally?
There is one actually just up the street, and they really make really nice ones, and they've been around for many, many years here, so it's kind of a staple in the Montreal area, and it's called Duc de Lorraine, Duc de la Lorraine. I'll send you the name.
Do you have any regrets?
No, I mean I miss clinical practice because I don't do it as often as I would like, just because of time. But I don't regret the path that I was put on because I think the opportunities that have come my way are more than I would have had in clinical practice. So I don't really have any regrets. I don't professionally, no, I don't. I really don't. So no, I don't do that. I think if I had to choose a regret is more, and it's not a regret, but it's a challenge of this job, is the family work balance. If I'm away at a conference, and this has happened to me many times, and I'm sure a lot of people that will eventually read this article or whatnot will understand, but if you're at a conference or you have an obligation and you're missing your kid's little speech show, whatever it is, when they're in the very young age, you feel guilty about it. You definitely have some sort of parent guilt there. And on the other hand, when you're, at your kid's show, you're saying, God, I have to give in this like thing by tomorrow, or I have to write an exam. And so you feel guilty, so it's this continual sort of like teeter tottering of guilt is what I should call it. That comes as being like, a parent and I guess a working parent.
Adulting is hard.
Yes, it is.
Here's our last question, and we inflict this one on everyone. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
I'm not much of a big crazy person. However, last year, we had a nice group of women come to Montreal, lots of colleagues, and I looked for something fun, crazy to do. So we all went axe throwing. Did you expect that answer?
No,
No,
but
there's
that
It really was a lot of fun. There is a place here in Montreal that started axe throwing, and I thought that that would be absolutely hysterical with this group of women that I wanted to do. We all had an absolute riot. They basically tell you a little bit of the history of axe throwing, how it actually started, and they tell you about the mechanics of how an axe sort of like, spins. And you get a chance to throw some axes, and you have different sizes of axes, so you have to sort of throw them differently. And you have this target, and we all pretended that it was our, nemesis or, whoever the people
whoever.
target. And we all had a hoot. It was hysterical. And then people tend to go to this place, for fun and just to release a little pressure. And we were all in either in academics or in industry or all optometrists, so we needed to relieve a lot of pressure, let's put it that way. So it was fantastic, and you get a whole bunch of pictures after that, and it's really a lot of fun. And it's like I understand. I mean, all the girls just like, what we're going to do, what? So like I said, I like to show off my city. I love traveling, and I love to be the sort of host with the most. And they will definitely remember axe throwing. So that's the craziest thing I've done. Thank
Great, great. Well, Andy, it's just absolutely great talking with you this morning. Thanks for
Oh,
taking the
thank you.
time to talk with me.
You're still thinking about that axe throwing, aren't you?
Well, yes. I
You know what you would like? You'd also like the name of this axe throwing place because the name of it is called Rage.
Well, yeah, you had a whole bunch of angry women optometrists. Well, not angry, but
We were not angry. We just
no.
needed to release some
You were,
stress.
that's right.
So there you
You're all unwinding. Again, Eddie, fantastic talking to you.
Thank
Thanks for
you.
taking the time to talk to me this morning. All
Thank
right.
you so much.